On va donner maintenant la parole à Emmanuel Alloa, qui est professeur invité à l'Université de Vienne en ce moment et qui est maître de conférence en philosophie à l'Université de Saint-Gallen. Il est aussi Senior Research Fellow au Pôle National Suisse de Critique de l'Image et il enseigne l'esthétique au département d'art plastique de Paris 8. Ses recherches portent en particulier sur les enjeux du témoignage et de la représentation visuelle de la violence extrême. Et en ce moment, il a un projet en cours sur la tyrannie de la transparence. Donc, à toi la parole.
Thank you. So for a long time, and I don't have any images for once, so we can turn this off probably, this kind of cinematic blue screen. I've prepared a text which I'm probably not going to read here, let me start by saying that for a long time, philosophers have reflected upon mobiles, and when they were usually inquiring into the reasons for certain actions or desires, and interrogating the mobiles was thus a way of perpetuating the old Greek project of the logon didonai, of giving reasons for certain processes. But with Maurizio Ferraris, we have learned that there might be other kinds of mobiles in philosophy, other kinds of mobiles philosophy has to deal with, and that for a large part escape reason. Le mobile a ses raisons que la raison ne connaît pas. So Michel Foucault said that since Kant, philosophy has had no new questions. The only thing that changes is that the old questions are transformed into provided with a certain index, the index of the contemporary. So Maurizio disputes that, and he has shown us that there are actually new philosophical questions. At the center of his book on the cell phone, there is the new philosophical question, where are you? Where are you? Which is the question that didn't exist at the age of landlines, which we've heard about this morning. So a new question arising, where are you? And this kind of topographical setting of the question has been transformed in his latest book on total mobilization, Mobilitazione Totale, into a new question, which in Italian reads as, chi me lo fa fare? So I think a rough translation in English would be something like, why on earth should I do that? But the literal translation is, of course, who makes me do that? And the grammarians have a specific term for this, and this is what they call the factative. So the factative is a category which describes verbs where someone transforms someone into something specific, turning someone into a slave, turning into someone into a captain or whatever, but also processes that make someone do something. And I think he's interested in this book and these factitive processes. And we observe within his work, I think, a shift from this rather static, almost topographic question of the where are we, when we use a phone, or a cell phone, mobile phone, towards this mobilization, which is already indicated with the suffix, the -ation. And I think, by the way, just as a sideline, I think it would be a useful therapeutic moment in New Realism 2.0 to move from realism to realization, but that's just a side remark. So mobilization, what about mobilization? I think we're observing an interesting move towards a more dynamic conception of his realist ontology, and I think it dovetails quite well with what he has been developing and what I think is a very important breakthrough in his parallel book, Emergenze. I think it hasn't come out in other languages so far, but I might be wrong. But that's not my task today, to discuss this notion of emergence, which I think would have lots of connections with other people here in the room, emergence, media, and so on and so forth. So what about this dynamic mobilizing dimension of the mobile? The concept of mobilization, Maurizio talks about it, is of military origin. So even before Ernst Jünger, and then of course Goebbels spoke of this total mobilization, it was used in 19th century, and it was used interestingly again in connection with the emergence of a new technology of transportation, which was a railway. And it was in the context of Russian warfare, where the question was how to make sure that large portions of the male population could be moved around very efficiently in short amount of time, which speaking of the 1850s and 60s. But there are also parallel concepts. In France, there is a concept of l'ordre de levée, which was a term used for Marines, French Marines, in mid-19th century. And it was actually a certain certificate granted to those Marines that were allowed to move around between harbors in France without having to report, without having to be documented by the local gendarmerie. So this idea that you can move freely around, this was associated with the levée. And I'm going to say something about the levée because it has a lot to do with what we're talking about here with the call of the mobile. So, lever une armée, general mobilization, raising an army corps, making them march in step. But être levé also means, of course, being up, being ready, being awake. The concept of standby, which is another concept of military origin, the readiness to duty, which defines the military ethos, has long been expanded to other domains, and that of technology in the first place. Just think of the fact that the standby mode is today the mode towards which the engineers want us to transform the machines towards. The idea that we don't have long times where the machine's starting up, warming up, but this permanently, the permanent readiness of the machine, which of course in turn also is something that is expected of its users, the permanent disposability, being disposable, being ready, being in place. Here we have a sideline of different issues, technological issues, issues of warfare, but of course also economic issues, because the idea is of a certain production mode that doesn't know any interruptions, doesn't know any stops, doesn't know any nighttime, and doesn't know anything like sleep, of course. So the machines don't have any form of sleep. And even the sleep mode is misleading. The sleep mode is wrong. There is no sleep mode for the machine. The point is that the sleep mode is no other name than the standby mode. It's the fact that the machine should be ready at any moment to be taken out of its sleep. And that's exactly what the warfare is working towards, having this kind of fighters that don't need any regeneration anymore, this capacity of providing people ready to fight for a long period of time. This is a central topic that Jonathan Crary talks about in his very important book, 24/7, The Sleeplessness of Late Capitalism. And he compares the research that has been carried out about certain birds, migrating birds, that migrate on the western coast of the United States. And these birds have the capacity of being awake for 8 days without substantially losing orientational capacities. And apparently the military are trying to produce fighters that could do the same. So the point is not to reduce the feeling of sleepiness, but is to reduce the need for sleep. That is the idea. So, of course, this idea that machines are something that doesn't have the need for sleep, that are never really turned off, and through mere pressure of a button, through movement sensors, they are back on tracks, ready to serve, is interesting because it capsizes, it turns upside down the idea that media would be extension of men, which is the old paradigm we find in Marshall McLuhan, of course, but it's actually a much older trope that we find already in this wonderful Hegelian named Ernst Kapp, The First Philosophy of Technology, 1877. If you've never read it, it's fantastic. You don't need Marshall McLuhan anymore. It's all there. So media as extension of men, kind of anthropological projection, is completely inverted, as Friedrich Kittler has told us. So it's not that media is the extension of man, it's man that becomes the extension of media, men that are molded upon their own devices, and hence this idea of the readiness is not something that would be some kind of a prosthetic idea of a negative anthropology of technology, where technology compensates the lack the humans have, but it's actually the opposite. It's just kind of repetition of this this standby mode for the very users of these media. So Maritza subscribes, I think, to a large part to the Kittler thesis, at least in some form. At least insofar as he considers that the affordances of the technical system, which he has been started to describe with the acronym ARMI, precede subjective action. And I think that's one of the I find most fruitful ideas in his thinking, this idea of affordance, using Gibson's concept of affordances that come from ecological psychology and use them in something like a technological environment. I find it extremely, extremely interesting. And by the way, Gibson has finally been translated into French, and I've just found out that the translator has had a very interesting way of translating this untranslatable concept of affordances, and he coined a new neologism, l'invite. That's the word he uses. It's an interesting translation. Anyway, so Total Mobilization, the latest book, starts with a scene that most of us are familiar with. It is the description of the reception of a message on a smartphone, and this message is, of course, not purely informational. It immediately is factitive. It provokes a reaction. It requires a response and sets into motion this whole process of activation, which he then calls mobilization. So I think this thesis is quite clear. The point is not that we're suffused with too much information. It's not about the attention economy, the fact that we are permanently exposed to too many things. It's rather something different, because if it were only for this kind of bombardment with information, we could simply listen to it, pay attention to it only with one ear, with the distracted attention. That is not the point. There is a kind of imperative to answer. There's an imperative to reply. There's an imperative to act. So I think this Levinasian figure can be, and the basis of his ethics, can be very well explained, or rather further specified, with what the German philosopher, phenomenologist Bernhard Weidenfeld has introduced here as a distinction between what he calls the address, appel, he says, and the demand, which he calls the Anspruch. So we could say that every call by the other in Levinas has a twofold dimension. It is a certain demand to do this or to do that, and this demand can be turned down, it can be not met, and this is what happens very often. And Levinas would always say it's not possible to even fulfill that demand to the right extent. But what Weidenfeld says is that the point is that the call as such, or the address, is inevitable. So there is no way you cannot not respond to this demand. Even if you pretend not to have heard it, even if you remain silent, even if you turn away, of course, as we all know, is already a form of recognizing this interpellation, this call. And this then connects with what the Palo Alto School has called the structure of the impossibility of communicating. I cannot not communicate, I cannot not answer, and as all logicians know, double negation is necessity. Okay, so this description, which is quite familiar from the ethical context, is now applied to the realm of technological interaction, and Maurizio even says it's even a more pervasive form of ethical interpolation, as most of the demands I'm confronted with are not demands that come from some kind of individual human face, but they are ubiquitous and they are formulated in forms of messages, in form of missed calls, or even in form of maybe friends requests on Facebook. And the friends request is a demand in its own form. So this permanent being faced with the expressions of something that has to be done. Of course, Maurizio denies that he's expounding an anthropological thesis, and he invents, nevertheless, half jokingly only, I think, the concept of the homo mobilitatus. So we're faced here with a certain new kind of hyper responsibility, where the hyper both refers to the hyper of the technology, but also to the change of scale, because of course it is impossible to respond to all these permanent interpolations at once. So this is already something that Levinas had said about the fact that the interpolation or the demand or the call of the other always takes place in the field of the third. So Levinas expounds this problem where he says, not only will I never be able to do justice to the other's address, but the other's address takes place in a field where the other is already the other of many other others. So the injustice is infinite, because of course even in answering one single demand, I will not be able, I'm turning down many other demands. So this kind of injustice increments itself infinitely. And this is, of course, if we take this on a technological scale, it's even multiplied. So the case, of course, borders on pathology, when in the middle of the night from Saturday to Sunday, the subject wakes up and wants to consult a watch. But the watch is, of course, much more. It has become a mailbox where work-related mail is looming, waiting to be answered, and hence the subject finds himself frantically back in the loop of work. So I'll be coming back to Maurizio's theorization of this framework towards the end, ask him a few questions which I'd like him to confront with, and he'll decide whether he wants to respond to them. But I have to do justice to the second half of my title and explain why transparency comes in here, and I think why there is a connection between total mobilization and what I'm currently most interested in. So let me briefly indicate a possible connection between the two. So the night from Saturday to Sunday, 3 o'clock in the morning, darkest night, is a moment that not even Henry Ford or Frederick Taylor had imagined to transform into a moment of productivity. I think this is the epochal change. Not even in their wildest night dreams did Frederick Taylor or Henry Ford imagine that we can extend productivity to such a point where we reach this moment of 24/7 ongoing productivity, because of course both Taylor and Ford had understood how important it was to let the workers find a moment of regeneration, which was important to the ultimate overall productivity. Now, of course, what do we do when there is this incessant work going on, when the difference between work and leisure time has been completely erased. And it's not by chance that the scene Mobilitazione Totale describes is a nightly scene. So we're in a moment, it's the weekend, leisure time, free time, but it's also nighttime, which is supposed to be a moment where work stops, where work is interrupted. And already in 1914, Marie-José Monzin recently reminded me of this wonderful text. I had never read it, I have to admit, but I read it as she pointed to me. We had a discussion 3 days ago about transparency and the disappearance of the night. And she pointed me to this text. It's called Schlaflose Nacht, 1914. And Zweig describes this moment, the disappearance of the night. He says sleeplessness is something that modernity is completely traversing modernity. And it's a text republished in his volume, Europe on the Brink. And so at the moment where uncertainty looms, people yield to the most minute events of the day. People haul their plow of anxieties and visions across the barren soil of night. So it's this permanent anxiety that people could miss something, and we're talking about 1914. It's a moment of dangerous of their life, but the moment that the permanent being tied to the permanent change in every minute of the day that make sleep itself something dangerous, because you could miss something. You could miss the fact that your city is being bombed, but of course you could also, in a more capitalistic mode, you could miss the moment of the opportunity of the life, and so on and so forth. This is also something that Jonathan Crary describes in his book 24/7, this disappearance of the night as the ultimate task of creating a form of productivity, of capitalist productivity, that knows no interruption, no exclusion, no pockets that could be resisting to this overall logic. And he describes, I'm just going to take one of the many examples he gives, this project that was launched in the 90s, a satellite project that was set up by a Russian engineer, already developed during Cold War, but then realized in the 90s. The idea was to launch into space large satellite panels with mirrors. And the idea is to collect the light, the sunlight, and redirect the sunlight onto parts of Siberia that were permanently in permanent darkness, and transform these sites into sites of 24-hour daylight sites where there could be infinite production. And progressively, the idea was to expand this from Siberia to other parts of the world so that we would need no moment of interruption of work anymore. I think this is a very speaking. It was not realized because there were resistances ecological movement, also people who said there is something like a human rights to rest and to the night and so on and so forth. It wasn't realized, but the project in itself, I think, is very telling. So the night is the moment of obscurity, is the moment of improductivity, but it's also the moment of danger, of course, of opacity, things going on in the dark that shouldn't be going on. And if you take the history of public lighting, it's very interesting. It is directly related with policing technology. So I've looked it up here for the Paris case. The first moments where something like public lighting was set up was directly related with the idea of repelling crime. Already in 14th century, Philippe le Bel introduces public lighting at the Châtelet, and he explains, we'll set up these torches here and crime will dwindle. And of course, then gas lighting, 19th century, from French Revolution, a very important moment where bringing the light to reduce crime rates, and then gas lighting. And all through the 19th century, we find this moment of light as being the best way to reduce uncertainty, to reduce danger, to increase security. But then we can go through this pragmatist utilitarian moment to the early 20th century. I always love to quote Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, a very important figure in the US legal history. And he declared in 1913, he declared the following: sunlight is said to be the best of disinfectants, electric light the most efficient policeman. So what's the idea here? The idea is that, of course, we can have regulation, of course, we can have a disciplinary regime, of course, we can punish people, lock them away, but actually the best way is to produce a kind of self-moralization. If you're exposed to surveillance, if you're exposed to full light, then you will automatically behave differently because you know that others will know. And this idea, this transformation of surveillance by some kind of external big brothers who is watching you, into the fact that people know what you are doing, which is already at the core of Bentham's panopticon, the idea that, and ultimately, you don't even need someone who's watching at the center of the panopticon prison. You just have to make sure that the inmates know that they are watched, and hence that they have to watch themselves, is actually very tightly connected with the idea of transparency. So if you make full light, you don't need to regulate anymore. You don't need to intervene. As a matter of fact, transparency negates the principle of intervention. Intervention as such is dangerous, because intervention means partial intervention. Someone intervenes, and someone who is intervening has some interests, has some stakes, and stakes are dangerous for democracy. So we're moving in the name of transparency towards protocols of self-regulation, protocols where human intervention is banned because it is deemed to be always put forward in the name of some dark interests that we don't necessarily have access to. So we could now move to an analysis, a contemporary analysis. I have to check on how much, I don't have much time left, so I will skip large part of this concept. But I ultimately think is that the obsession with transparency that we have today, transparency as put forward by of course whistleblowers, by people like Julian Assange, WikiLeaks, Edward Snowden, and in the name, of course, of something like public accountability, accountability of governments, is strangely shared by people who should not agree with them in principle. How come that President Obama has made transparency a linchpin of his presidency? How come that CEOs, and this is maybe something where I disagree with what has been said this morning at some point, it is not true that transparency is something that is withheld from private firms. It might be the case that, as a matter of fact, we don't have access to that, but transparency is the most favorite concept that CEOs use in their annual speeches alongside with authenticity. So transparency is everywhere. Transparency reports are ubiquitous. In January this year, 2016, the National Security Agency released its first transparency report. Now, I don't know what that means when intelligence agencies start to release transparency reports, but just to tell you what this transparency rhetoric means today, it means a total negation of conflict. People who should not agree pretend to be doing the same thing in the name of transparency. It pretends to be post-ideological, it pretends to be post-individualistic, it pretends to be post-partisan. It pretends, of course, to cause something like kind of self-regulating system where no intervention is needed anymore. As a matter of fact, at some point, maybe we don't need humans anymore in a perfectly open governance. I'm going to skip all this part. If you want me, if we have time, we can come back to this. But I think what is looming here is the idea of a democratic society that wouldn't need decisions anymore. we're moving towards a system of self-steering, self-regulation, where no cuts, no decisions, no judgment actually is needed anymore. Judgment as such is dangerous. So whatever is unquantifiable, unpredictable, is dangerous. Or in a way, as Derrida would say, judicial decisions as such have to be made disappear because they concern the undecidable. We only need to decide where something is undecidable, Derrida famously said. Well, let the algorithm decide, of course, because judges are known to be unpredictable. So we need to draw various conclusions here, I believe. And we have to ask ourselves, what is it, this kind of fear of the unpredictable? What about this fear of the undecidable? I think more than ever, times is haunted by a fear of the unknown. And we're sacrificing on the altars of transparency, and our cults start to resemble those of the religion of the late Roman Empire, mere formal exercises devoid of any faith, meant to distract as practitioners from experiencing their ultimate emptiness. So this kind of 24/7 time hopping, time zone hopping, continuous self-exposure we perform on virtual networks, as if we had a genuine fear of missing out something, strikingly begins to resemble this desperate quest for a life free of lacks and lacunae. No aspect of our lives is to be spared, nothing to be left in the dark, no taste for the secret. And now I'm coming back to some questions I would like to ask Maurizio. So I'll skip actually the part I had on everything I agree upon, and I think there are many, many important things. To begin with, this critique of collective intentionality, which I totally share, and again, collective intentionality as again a very ironic and harmonizing conception of the social, doesn't explain the existence of institutions, but also the conflictual nature of coexistence. I share with some of his critiques of other ontological conceptions. I agree with many, many points on the question of importance of writing and of memory. And of course, I agree with this idea that it is, or this conception of responsibility as emerging from this process of interpolation or a claim of demand, that in a way ethics don't come first, as opposed to what Levinas says. The process of responsabilization is itself the result of a primary form of address, and this address is not of ethical nature as such. Now, but let me skip the parts on which I agree because we have little time, and I'm going to ask him a few questions. The first one is, how important is the militarization argument? So, of course, that's the title of the book, Total Mobilization, and there's a kind of play on this Goebbelsian moment, total mobilization. The book says at some point, war that is fought not with the sword, but with pens, pads, and iPads. And I'm not totally clear what the functional broad of this argument. So, of course, it's a very Kittlerian argument to say most media technologies actually were born out of the spirit of war. And Turing would be a good example here. And this is empirically and historically true. But what do we do with this? And certainly, what does it mean to take media communication to be the continuation of war with other means? If mobilization is total, of course, we move beyond military means. And when Goebbels spoke about the total war, of course, he meant total in a total way. That is, not only a military war, but a kind of mobilization that goes far beyond something that we call weapons fighting against each other. So this would be one of the questions. I see this as a problem throughout the book, by the way, that some kind of genealogical, historical claim is then mixed with ontological claims. And there are often tensions of this type. Like at some point in the book, it says, we are living in the age of registration. Now, if registration is an ontological condition, and I totally subscribe to that, how can there be an age of registration? By the way, I think I personally like the concept of registration more than the one of documentation, because it allows to move beyond the scriptural discursive mode and think of registration that is can be psychological too. There are many ways of acknowledging something, and I think is a much more diagonal concept, but we could talk about this. One can say that we are permanently under fire, just as neurologists tell us that neurons constantly fire, but could it be that such metaphors say more about the imaginaries of the inventors than about the alleged objects? So what do we do when we use this kind of military metaphor? I think we have to be quite conscious about what that means. And I found it all the more surprising that at some point in the book, it is said the web, so there's a kind of way of saying it's not about Big Brother, it's not about bad interests, a kind of self-emergent processes. But that goes as far as to say the web was born as a network of researchers outside of any political, economic, and social project. Whoa. I mean, the internet, we all know, was run by researchers, the ARPANET, the beginning of it all. But the ARPANET was run by researchers, all paid by the U.S. Department of Defense. And the point was to set up a system of distributed command centers which could allow the United States to remain functional even after a targeted strike on its main commando centers. So I don't really get the argument here. Second argument, constructivism. So you make a very strong point to go against excessive interpretationalism and constructivism. Now, it might be that constructivism held its grip on social sciences for a long time in the past decades, but let's agree a moment on what constructivism means. When you write, we are not the constructors of meaning, but at best it's receptors, and most of the time it's willing executioners. I don't think this will be anything scandalous to people that would subscribe to the thesis of social constructivism. Constructivism doesn't mean that we construct the things that we find ourselves situated in. Constructivism means that things are not simply given. So when I say that Paris is a constructed city, I don't mean to say that I constructed the city, nor that it was necessarily someone else who constructed it, but I find myself in a situation where I cannot simply freely decide to move around. So I don't think constructivism can simply be equated with idealism here. So we can also talk about this more at length and about the Kant critique. I think it was Schelling who invented this idea that transcendental forms are like Waffeleisen, waffle irons. It was taken up by Fichte. I don't know. Do we know exactly who invented this idea? So I don't even want to debate whether it is correct to describe Kantianism in such a way. I think most Kantians would disagree. But for sure, it is problematic to say that I invented the waffle iron, which I then used to mold my world. Social constructivists would, of course, say that is, I find myself in a world where there are many waffle irons, which I certainly didn't contribute shaping. Then I would have a question, third question, about your very central distinction between social and natural entities. That I have to say, I have the greatest problems with. Sorry, I see why you want to save a certain heritage from deconstruction and at the same time be realist, but the distinction as such is problematic, because if we say that there are things like social entities that we can modify, change, and there are natural facts like the tip of the Himalayas that I cannot modify, then what about social acts like all the performatives that Austin was analyzing? The point is, of course, it's a social act. But when the right appropriate person declares two people to be man and wife, it's not emendabile. You cannot do this But people will never be unmarried. They will be divorced afterwards. So there's a kind of natural history of social facts that points towards the inemendabilità of social facts. Fourth point, memory or consciousness. Very quickly, page 44. It's not true that justice absolves people if they don't remember the crimes they committed. Luckily so. It would be terrible. So you claim that justice absolves people if they don't remember the crimes they committed. And your example, you quote from an article on this guy in Wales who was a somnambulist and who strangled his wife during sleep and then who didn't remember it and was acquitted. Well, he was not acquitted because he didn't remember what he did. He was acquitted because he was a somnambulist and he was considered to be not fully conscious at the moment he did what he did. So I think we're mistaking different points here, and that's a good news, because if people could simply be acquitted because they don't remember what they did, well, then we would have many cases of conscious.
I never said that.
It's page 44. You can look it up.
The French edition.
It's in a footnote, and I think faked amnesia or true amnesia was enough. I think most perpetrators would be well off. So emergentism, but that's probably only a detail. So although I largely subscribe to the emergentist explanation, which solves a vast number of problems social scientists usually find themselves confronted with, I'm not sure how the concept of revelation proves to be helpful here. I'm a bit surprised that this seems to be a new important concept for you. So to say that in an emergentist ontology there is no prescripted telos of evolution, no finalism or teleology, but the emergence of something new which had to be registered in order to exist is a very interesting thought, because I think it solves many, many divides like nature-culture divide, living, non-living, etc., etc. But to call this, to tie this to revelation seems totally counterintuitive to me. Isn't the point about registration or documentation that it comes in belatedly? We don't need to be there as witnesses of the emergence of something new. And as a matter of fact, most emergencies can only be described in retrospect, belatedly. There's a passage in Merleau-Ponty, which I always like, where he says, je n'assiste, ce n'est toujours qu'après coup que j'assiste à la naissance de ma calvitie. So you're never there in the moment where baldness starts. So there's an emergence of a new phenomenon, but there's not a revelation of emergence. So I'm having some trouble with the reintroduction of this kind of simultaneous immediacy concept of revelation. And in a sense, the emergence of the new is not dependent on its appearance as something new. And I think this is an important lesson. I also learned from you and from others, ontology has to be independent from epistemology. And if we tie the emergence of entities to their epiphanies, I think we're falling back into the traps of epistemologization. I have other questions here, but I'm stopped because I'm already far beyond time. And well, thank you, and sorry for bombarding you with all these different thoughts.
It would be difficult to be short in answering. I will try to it. Before every answer, many thanks for the generosity of the analysis and then the acumen of the question. Very quickly, militarization. This was simply in order to show to underline the paradox of the fact that Goebbels did not succeed in what succeeded to this kind of nothing more on this, except the fact that in fact this kind of device are also military device, whereas in a sense also the plans, the map were military device, but Now, this kind of objects are permanently present in military life, and this makes that before, except in Wild West, people were not bringing weapons with them. Now we are bringing something which, of course, if it is a Samsung 7, is even even more dangerous. But this about registration, I don't find a contradiction, because what as I was saying, registration is the basis of social life. We are in the age of registration because of the explosion of the registration. We have immediately infinitely more registration device than 10 years ago, than 20 years ago. This room is full of recording device. If we imagine this scene 20 years ago, there will be just not even a camera, not this, not just this, which is a recording device, but should be a voluntary recording device. I have to write, here's this sound automatic, and this too. So it's, we live in the age of recording because the quantity and the automaticity of the recording is something that makes a real change before what we are speaking about, the fact that, that our lives seemingly are transformed now, depends from this explosion of recording. And this allows me also to explain what I mean by revelation. Recording was existing before, but it was hidden because it was rare, scarce. Sometimes there were documents. We were looking for documents. We were producing documents. Now, this inflation, in a sense, of documents make it so that reveals an hidden structure of what society is, independently of technique. This is the sense of revelation. On the question of internet and the war, here I believe that, for instance, the expert is Juan Carlos, for instance. But as far as I know, internet was conceived as a war instrument in order to allow the President of the United States. But the web was conceived as a scientific way of communication. Maybe I am wrong, but as far as I know, there is this difference. About Paris, sorry for, I am aware of the fact that Paris is constructed. I know, I suppose that Paris is constructed. Nonetheless, the fact that Paris is constructed doesn't allow me to transform it by a pure fiat or will, as I can change my mind, supposing that I can change my mind. And this is a way to say that usually constructivism pretend to be much more than it is. Because if you say, well, all the things you can find it are constructed. And I say, well, so what? About the performative, all, as I said before, all my theory comes from, of social objects, comes from an attempt to reintroduce the role of speech acts in social reality, because the way in which John Searle uses this theory of speech acts make it all dependent from intentions, and in my sense they are depend on document. Then therefore this make it so that marriage is unamendable, because I cannot say I simply change idea, because there is a document, so that I can divorce but not cancel the intention, which is what happens in our mental life, how many times we change intention, and maybe even we don't remember the previous intention. And for the question of killing the wife, which is a way of amend the marriage, but for the question of killing the wife, I should test, because I'm not sure that the translation is correct. I go to the Italian text. Many thanks in any case, because if I say this, I am wrong and you are right. I hope that, thank you very much.
Nous avons encore le temps pour une question pour Emmanuel Alloa. Et ensuite, nous passerons à la conversation après la pause entre Jocelyn Benoît et Maurizio Ferraris. Qu'est-ce qu'il y a ? Une question, Enrico. Enrico Terrone.
If a question on transparency, indeed, I would like to better understand your use of the notion, what you really means by transparency, and I wonder whether your notion of transparency has some link to the notion of transparency that you, which is used in the debate about pictures. So, for example, what Walton calls seeing through, or Stanley Cavell, also Stanley Cavell claims that film are transparent in some sense. That is a device that gives us a direct access to reality. So a mirror is transparent in a sense in which a painting is not, since in a painting the vehicle, the pictorial vehicle, show up in experience, whereas in a mirror I do not have an experience of the marks, or but just I have a sort of direct relation to the subject. So two questions connected: which notion of transparency are you using, and whether there is a connection between your notion of transparency and this notion of transparency?
It's actually not. It's not not a notion that it would be unfamiliar to me. I have to confess that this is something I've been working on a lot in the past. So it was one of the central questions in my book on images. So that was the work I was using. That was the concept of transparency I was discussing, and I oppose the transparent and the diaphanous. So I'm interested in the notion that was transparency itself was coined to translate a Greek term, which means that the operator of appearances, diaphanestai. So the dia is really the medium of appearances that we find in Aristotelian thinking. And I try to show how there was a forgetfulness or oblivion of the medium in the traditional epistemology of vision and of images. That was my. This is the book that is published in German, Das durchscheinende Bild. So I discussed Walton, I discussed these people, and I think all of them consider at some point that we can either, at large or more specifically in certain media, negate the medium. So supposedly photography is a medium that is the best to negate mediality as such, where we don't see the medium, we see through the image. And someone brought up the punctum by Roland Barthes before. Of course, there's a moment where there is a sting of the image that at impedes to just go through and have the gaze go through the image. But I'm interested in his logic of operation. And I think, of course, most of the operations are particularly efficient when they pretend to be transparent. So I think the reflection is about, we have to do is about these processes of what are the operators and the media of whether that is an aesthetic process, an epistemic process, a political process. And transparency is a negation of the operation wherever. So there, the connection between these different fields is the negation or the self-effacement of the process. And wherever we have a process, we have something unpredictable. And when we negate the process, we negate that something else can happen than what we thought. We all know the situation. We come into a room and we're supposed to take a decision. It's this decision-making process, and we realize that decision was taken long time before the session opened, and we're just there to make sure that there's a democratic basis for the decision. But it's not a decision-making process. And that's in the name of transparency, but it's actually just a form of acclimation of a decision that was prescripted and was decided elsewhere. So this is what I want to question with this name of transparency.